once again, hello everyone. At the request of His Excellency, he and myself and Larry LaCrosse from Catholic Human Services are recording another session just to bring people up to date with several things that have gone on in our diocese, but also across the Catholic world. You are going to, hello Larry.
Hello, Father.
Larry's actually with me, but you're about to hear. The Bishop is not with Larry and I, and I'll let the Bishop explain that himself. Over to you, Your Excellency.
Good evening, good morning, whatever, afternoon. I just, right after the announcement came out, and by Friday I was coming down with a cold. I normally get one of these things once a year, and this year it happened to come right at that particular moment when I could feel something happening to my voice and some congestion.
Does that mean that you're allergic to Alabama?
What's that?
Does that mean that you're allergic to Alabama?
I don't know if I'm allergic to Alabama or not. It might very well be, but I think that their weather is, I think, significantly more mild than maybe it would be here. I think they only get about 1 inch of snow, so I think we're pretty good on that score.
Okay.
I'm going to miss all that. I'm going to miss four distinct seasons, I think, pretty much.
Yes.
But at any rate, I get this thing that lasts usually about a week, maybe two, but once a year, and normally I get it in February, end of January, February. This year it has come right now. So it comes at a very inopportune moment because I don't know whether it's the regular flu or whether it's connected with the COVID-19. I don't think it is, because all I've been taking my temperature, it seems to be pretty within the normal range. And so I've been monitoring that pretty well. But I know that I need to at least be quarantining myself just to prevent it in case it happens to be that. So that's why I'm pretty much at home right now. And there's enough to do at home, as well as to spend extra time in prayer, to sleep, relax, and do some work as well. But it just is a moment, almost like a retreat for me. Except for the fact that I have a cough and some nasal congestion. So,
but just for clarity, you have actually spoken to your physician.
Oh yes, I've spoken with my physician, and I keep up in touch with him. So he's just asking me to monitor it right now, and so I keep tabs of, as I said, my temperature. I take that every couple hours just to kind of watch and see where it is, and then other symptoms as they appear, but they seem to be within the range of everything that I've had in the past.
Okay.
So that leads me to believe that it's perhaps not COVID. I can't rule that out 100%. But I think that it's more of the typical flu or cold that I would get every year.
Okay, so you feel dreadful and lousy.
Yes.
But why? So then why are you recording a radio program?
Because I just want everybody to know that I'm not abandoning them. And I don't want people to think that just because the announcement came out on Wednesday and suddenly don't see me at Mass on TV or on the weekend, that somehow I've disappeared out of sight. And it's just another reason why I just couldn't be in the presence of other people to be able to do that. Normally I'd have Father Matthew assisting me, or another priest, or at the cathedral there's a couple priests there, so they would assist. And so not being able to be present, one might be thinking that, well, suddenly he's disappeared. I have not disappeared. When Bishop Hebda was named to Newark back in 2013, I believe it was, he was named as a coadjutor, which means that his appointment took effect immediately.
Okay.
And so he lost all of his authority here at the time that it was announced. Mine is what you might consider a regular transfer, so it is announced, but there's usually a period of 1 to 2 months that you have to do the transfer according to law. But because of the situation we find ourselves in, they've allowed me to take an additional month, so the schedule of the appointment will take effect on the 23rd of June. That's when the installation will be. So in that sense, it allows me to stay here with the people in this diocese, the priests and the people of this diocese, during this interim period, to get us through, I guess, some of the, how would you say, get us through some of the difficulties we currently are facing.
Okay.
That are very unusual. So they've allowed that as a very kind of them, and, you know, to be able to do that.
Does that mean that that because of what we're going through just now, that the timetable is not written in stone? Because we had the governor saying she can't envisage people going back to school before the summer. We've actually no idea how this is going to really, really impact Michigan, or for that sake, Alabama.
Right, exactly. Alabama seems to be farther behind than we are here, so their cases are relatively small. But they are in this sort of a state where they cannot gather. I forget if it's 25 people or less down there. So they are under some kind of a restriction right now of movement as well. But our cases are advancing much more exponentially than theirs are.
Okay, so before we move on to, I've got some specific questions about some of this. I'll turn to Larry, who is a layman of our diocese and comes from a large family. Anything that what are you hearing when people got this news that the bishop was being transferred?
Well, certainly a lot of shock and surprise, and certainly a great measure of sadness, Bishop, because like Father Scott said, you're very well loved, and we will miss you very, very much. So the other reaction I think people had is that this comes as a particular at a particularly challenging time, and as you pointed out, the decision and you finding out about this happened before the epidemic, but the announcement comes in the middle of the epidemic, and so that I think it was a challenge for people to perceive that, but knowing that you're going to be with us for some additional months. Specifically, you know, when we saw the dates of the transfer and installation, knowing that you'd have the opportunity to ordain Deacon Alex and Michael, I think that is something that's certainly very good. So it'll be difficult because we will miss you very much, but we definitely. You go with our hopes and prayers and well wishes for Alabama. And like Father Scott said, the other reaction is what it would be like to move from the state where your family is and the state that you've been most of your life, with the exception of Italy, and, you know, most of the way across the country down to the south and in a completely different environment. That was a discussion that we've had is, I think it's a wonderful example of radical obedience to the needs of the church.
Somebody, a parishioner here who's from Alabama, said to me, "You'll need to learn how to say y'all."
Yes, I will. I have a bishop down there who's offered to teach me Southern lessons. So,
really?
That will be kind of interesting. He's a native Southerner, so he knows that very well.
Okay.
I've never been to Alabama. I've never been to Birmingham. Never traveled through the airport or anything. So I have no idea what to even expect. So this is really sort of launching out into the deep, almost, or going beyond the pillars of Hercules or something.
Yes.
It just really is something so, so I don't even know what to expect. So I'll just leave it that way. The people that I've spoken with, the bishop that I've spoken with, were just so kind. And when I look at the website of the diocese, there's a lot going on there. And I think perhaps the one thing that is probably most notable about that diocese is the home of EWTN,
indeed.
Right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So whenever Mass is celebrated there, you'll hear my name all over the world.
That's true.
Because I've prayed for our bishop. So I think that at least I'll be present in people's homes, but maybe in a different way. To tune into EWTN.
I believe if the song is accurate, then they've all got banjos on their knees.
Yeah, probably.
And I'm reliably informed they sound more foreign than me.
Yes, I know.
Says the Scottish priest but, in northern Michigan.
I know.
Yeah, but at least northern I can say Michigan. Y'all.
So. Yes, all in the plural is all you all.
Okay. So one of the things that of course people are asking is, this seems really unjust that Alabama know they're getting you, and we don't know who we are getting. And yeah. You know, they're saying, you've mentioned that you've known this for a certain length of time, and people will feel, well, here we go. This is because we're a rural diocese. That we're being ignored. You know the way that not everybody, but many people in the Diocese of Gaylord think that everything revolves around the towns, and so as you exponentially, you can say that many people think the Vatican's not interested in rural places; it's only interested in cities. Before you answer that, though, how much bigger population-wise is Alabama for Catholics than Gaylord?
I don't know about Alabama on the whole, but I know that within the diocese where I'm going, there are about 3 million people and about 105,000 Catholics. So that is about 3%, something like that.
Okay.
And so we're actually less Catholic down there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. There's a large number of Baptist, Bible Belt-type churches down there. So it tends to be a Christian, strongly Christian area. On the whole.
Okay.
But the Catholic churches are spread, I think, 55 parishes, if I'm not mistaken. I don't remember the exact number.
Okay.
But also some religious communities there, too, both religious sisters and some Benedictine communities. So there's men communities. So I think that there's a large number of priests who are there.
That's one less headache. That's a different kind of headache for you, then.
Yes, it is a different kind, but it does speak of that particular area. Obviously, there's something that was attractive to certain people too.
Mm. So, could you say something about why is Alabama know that they're getting you, and we don't know who's going to replace you?
Well, yeah, the way that the Holy See operates is that they usually don't have somebody in mind or start working on the project until the See. Or the bishop's chair is actually vacant. And just like they don't start working on who the next pope is until the pope dies.
Yes.
And then they gather together and they start the process of determining who the next pope is. So unlike for a pastor where we kind of anticipate those moves, in the world of the bishops, they don't do that until the see is actually vacant. So they won't start working on this until after the 23rd of June.
Are you consulted on that?
I don't know. I've never done this before, so I'll find out.
Okay. In the meantime, how will the diocese be governed?
Our diocese will be governed in one of two ways that I can think of right now. It falls to the College of Consultors. The consultors take over when the see is vacant or is impeded. They have the governing function, just like the College of Cardinals do when the Holy See is vacant. And so the consultors then, right after I take possession down there, would gather in session, and they would vote for who an administrator would be. Mm-hmm. And that person would have to accept, and then that name is forwarded then to the nuncio. Alternatively, the Holy Father could choose an apostolic administrator and bypass that process, and then just appoint someone, typically a retired bishop or an auxiliary bishop someplace, or a bishop from another diocese to govern in the interim before an actual bishop is named.
So that second one, that's the one that we saw with Saginaw?
That's correct. That's correct. That's what you saw in Saginaw. Cleveland saw the same thing. Right now, Cleveland, in its current situation, has elected somebody from the internal.
But after after Bishop Cooney and after Archbishop Hebda, mm-hmm. it was elected, but it was the Vicar General, Monsignor Murphy, wasn't it?
Yes, it was Monsignor Murphy who was elected by the consultors.
And do you,
then he governed the diocese as the administrator.
Do you convene that yourself before you go, or is that done after you
depart? No, that's done afterwards. I have no role in that whatsoever.
Okay.
So it's the oldest member of the consultors would convene the group, and then they would meet.
So some people have asked, both Father Joe and I imagine this has happened elsewhere as well, does that mean you're getting moved, Father? And where will you be moved to? And does that mean we're going to get a new priest? Could you say something to... I know you can't predict how the new person will function, but good governance, generally speaking, when you go... Like, you're going to Alabama. You're not going to be going to Alabama and moving people within a month, unless it's something very, very peculiar.
Right, unless there's something really peculiar. Normally they have their process, and you just fall into whatever their process happens to be. Okay. I think that would be true here, too. The administrator would not, other than things that are already in process, would typically not start moving people around. They might, if there was a particular need, somebody passed away, where they might have to then say, would you do this, or somebody became very sick, that might be necessary, but you're usually the administrator has the responsibility of what is called nihil innovator. Nothing is to be innovated during that time, which means the status quo prevails insofar as it is possible. But if you have things in the works, that doesn't halt them. They can continue on towards a logical conclusion.
Okay. Okay. Is there anything else that you would like to say about how this news affected you? I mean, obviously, you took it to prayer. Whether or not, when you were asked, you immediately thought, yes, great. Or whether you thought, why can't I go back to Italy or Poland? Or why can't I just retire?
In all honesty, I really thought this was going to be a terminal appointment, that I would retire from here in 2027, 2028. And... that would be it, and I would be a priest of Baylor the rest of my life. And I was very happy with that. I didn't perceive any change in the works. And so I had no idea that this was even being talked about. So it did come to me as an overall surprise. I try not to get involved in who's going where and what, how and why, because I don't find that to be particularly useful. My aim was to serve the people of this diocese, and that's what I wanted to do. And I really would have, committed the rest of my years here without any difficulty. It's a beautiful diocese. I remember talking to Cardinal Sciocca before he passed away when I was just named, and he too had spoken very, very fondly of the diocese, and said that you would absolutely love the people of this diocese. And I do. He was absolutely right. Bernie Hebda said the same thing. Bishop Rose said the same thing. Bishop Cooney had passed away before I'd been able to speak with him. So that wasn't possible at all, although I knew Bishop Cooney from years back in the seminary.
Who would have put your name forward? How does that work?
He was my liturgy professor back in those days. Okay. So. Yes, go ahead.
Who would have put your name forward? How does that work? How did you get on the radar of the nuncio?
I have no idea. Father's God, I have no idea. I have no idea.
Okay, I'll come clean. It was me. I'm joking about that, everyone.
Unless there were some people that wanted to be gone for some reason, they probably put in my name. I have no idea.
Okay.
So, truth be told, I would have been completely happy year of the rest of my days. And so now I'm going into this big unknown, and we'll see where it goes.
Yes.
Have a beautiful plan in place. There'll be surprises. There'll be miracles. There'll be fantastic things that happen. There'll be certain challenges. Mm. But the Lord's in charge of all of this now.
So I'm not going to ask you about what the lows are, because that's not really, it's not a Catholic thing to do. We learn from them and we move on. But what are some of the highlights, some of the precious things that you'll take away from your 5.5 years? 5 years?
Yeah, it's about 5.5 years, right.
So, I mean, mm-hmm. I understand the ultimate highlight would be ordaining me, and then second to that would have been ordaining me a deacon. That I understand. But apart from that...
you weren't going to speak of any laws.
Did you hear what Larry said there?
No, I didn't.
He said, I wasn't going to... I said, let's not talk about any laws.
No. No, let's not talk about the laws. I think, you know, certainly we've seen some beautiful things happen here. I mean, there was getting around to the parishes for First Communion and Confirmation is always a highlight for a bishop. And I miss that. And I miss that quite a bit this year because, you know, we're still trying to figure out how Confirmation is going to work out.
Yes.
So that was one thing that was happening. I sure enjoy getting out to the fish fries, that's for sure, too. But I think even things like Faith Magazine has been really significant in the lives of people. And we hear anecdotally how people have come back to the faith because of it. Because they're hearing stories of faith, and they're reading about them, and they get inspired. And so I think we just had an issue recently about the Punschki that's done over in Alpina.
We did. Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that highlight and kind of toots the horn of various parishes or individuals of what they're doing, that can be a very beautiful thing for others to know about. And okay. I think those are certain highlights that are just extraordinary, you know.
Observationally, looking back to our diocese and not that old, do you think then, now having been a bishop for a while, that it was the wise thing to do to change the diocesan map of Michigan in order to create Gaylord and then Kalamazoo and things like that?
No, it was back in 1971. Gaylord and Kalamazoo were established. And I think, you know, it was probably prudent at that particular moment. Being from part of the diocese, part of Grand Rapids or part from Saginaw, could have seemed like it was way, way out in the frontier, the hinterland. And this way, we're dealing with the whole diocese in all of its unique aspects in this north region above M55. I think it's just really an extraordinary place overall of natural beauty, but also deep faith. And I see people who have real passion for their faith, passion for a spiritual life, passion to want to get things right. Even, I would say, even those who might not agree with everything that I do and maybe challenge me, have a real passion for wanting to do this right and wanting to see the best happen.
What's the would you say, are the biggest challenges of such a widespread... I say this because our diocese is the size of my country. It's the size of Scotland. Scotland's very slightly bigger if you take in the islands, and that's even if you include the Bear Island here. But what are the kind of... When you were appointed and you look at the map and you think, if I'm in the centre in Gaylord, 2.5 hours, 3 hours one way, 3.5, 2 hours another way, and then another way, what advice would you be giving to your predecessor about getting their head around the geographical size, unless they come from somewhere like Alaska, for example? Thought I'd throw that out to start a rumor. I'm throwing out Alaska to start a rumor.
No, well, everything is doable within a day here. So mm-hmm. you could go to Manistee and come back within a day. You could go to Tawas and come back in a day. Everything is doable within a day. That's not always true in some dioceses. In some cases, they're the whole state. Like in Wyoming, the entire state. And the diocese is in one corner of the state. I think we're sort of a small to medium-sized diocese from territory-wise. Mm-hmm. The diocese I'm going to is 39 counties. This one is 21. And what I came from was 10. So there's a greater maybe a density downstate than there is up here. More social distancing naturally, I suppose. But I think it really does lend itself to people who enjoy the rural character, the lakes, the Lake District throughout the diocese, and the unique aspects of the diocese, to really enjoy being part of that and being a Catholic presence in the midst of it all. I'm always touched by these things that I hear and the pride that people have in their parishes. And so that continues to be edifying for me personally. But also at those moments when we have to make some maybe difficult or not so popular decisions about the disposition of a parish if it's waning, these are not always easy to do because you know you're going to hurt some people. And at the same time, you don't want to, but you want to make sure that you're streamlining things in a way that are going to be best serving the vast majority of people.
Yes.
So I pain every time I have to do that. And yet sometimes it's looking at the greater good and not just because individual connection or individual desire on one part about a particular building, as beautiful as they might be, but to say what is the greater community need at this particular moment in order that it can function as is envisioned for a parish to function.
You know, I wonder if there's parallels to this. When I was a student RN, you would wonder where was the RN that you were working with. And then when I became an RN, I wondered about where's the charge nurse? And when I became a charge nurse, I wondered where the student RN was and the RN was. And when I became a manager, I used to wonder where everybody was and why was I having to deal with everything and why did nobody understand what I was having to deal with. Is there parallels to that?
I suppose. Certainly everybody is very fond of their pastor. The people that lead their parish, some parishes, parochial administrators, are very fond of them because they coordinate the activity of the parish life or their deacon. And then they wonder, sometimes they say, well, where's the bishop in all of this? And then the bishop says, where are the priests? Those who are helping now. So, I suppose in one sense, our church, unlike maybe the government, is really sort of flat. It doesn't take many steps to get to the top.
Yeah.
And, there's myself and we're part of the College of Bishops, of which the Pope is one. So
yes,
it's very, very quick step up. And I think we're really impressed by the fact, I'm always impressed. You know what I am always taken by is how decentralized the church is. And that how important that is that things happen on certain levels. They don't always happen at the top, right? We're inspired by that.
Yes.
But the main action in the front lines is where the parishes are. And each parish is unique. It's different. Each diocese is different and unique. But there's not a Catholic Church USA. And maybe that frustrates a lot of people who are trying to get at the Catholic Church because we're so decentralized and the thing that people have and their discipleship happens to be around a local parish community to which they belong, which in charity expresses its link to other similar Catholic churches and then together with the bishop as the main shepherd trying to hold it all together. But that constitutes a Catholic church in and of itself. And the diocese does. So it's not, you say the Catholic Church and you think of Rome. Well, it's not just Rome. It's this local community, too, that is the face of the Catholic Church.
Yes.
And each parish is the face of the Catholic Church. So with its pastor, proper pastor. Mm-hmm. So I just find that to be a remarkable, utterly remarkable organizing mechanism that we have. That really helps to serve the mission of the church in making Christ known. Mm-hmm. So those are just my simple thoughts on the matter. But a lot of things, when questions come in, we're saying, at which level does this have to be handled at? Does it have to be handled at the bishop's level, or should it be handled at the pastor? Or should it be handled at the dean, the vicar of the region? So we're trying to figure out where does this particular issue get handled the best. And this is all, again, part of this decentralization, if you want to call it that, or I'm trying to think of the rest, subsidiarity, that's a formal term.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Where things are handled at a proper, at its own proper level.
You know, Bishop, in kind of my thinking and reflecting on this move, when I was reading your letter, I think you wrote a letter to the faithful. I think this was the one posted on the website, if I remember correctly. But there were a couple of statements in there that just struck me and just gave me a new insight into the apostolic nature of the role of the bishop. Because, mm-hmm. you know, kind of seeing you here, yes, you know, having you here, the plan, you know, of having you here till you retire, but that this call came from the Holy Father to do apostolic work in another place. It just gave me an image of the early church because, mm-hmm. you know, until really the church became developed and more structured and settled, that was the work of the early apostles, was to travel from place to place, nurture that mm-hmm. place, and then move on. And that has not always been our experience, but I think there's something about this that reminded me of that, is that you have a work here, and that the call is now to go to Birmingham, and that mm-hmm. we have that unique characteristic of being a church here, but as a church, we cannot hold on to your apostolic presence, in a sense, that we have to be open mm-hmm. to our connection with the universal church and our connection with other places.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. And I think, you know, you think a lot like St. Paul, who really traveled out that throughout that whole Middle East area, just enough to get something established, and then moved on to the next place.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Kind of left them on their own, I guess, with the local people in charge. But he would come by periodically and check up on them. It's much like that, the Lord saying, you know, we can't stay here, we have to move on to the next place.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's this sense of restlessness in the urgency of the ministry to kind of move on to the next place, that things are developed to a point where they can continue on, and then you move on to the next place and see what impact you can have there. Maybe some of the things that I wasn't able, maybe there are things that I may not have been able to do that my successor will be able to do. And, you know, that's part of the complementarity of leadership, too. Yeah. It happens in parishes where one pastor can do certain things, and the next pastor does complementary things that the other pastor wasn't able to do. And it all brings out the fullness of what can be done in parish life or in diocese and life.
It's as you mentioned it earlier on, the unbroken line. The expression, of course, we use in Britain is "the king is dead, long live the king."
Yeah, it's right.
The thing carries on. But just as a very slight aside, I'm sure there are going to be some people who are going to be thinking, okay, so next bishop, he'll only be here for 5 years and he'll be moved. That's not going to necessarily be the case, is it?
No, it's not going to necessarily be the case. It certainly wasn't with Bishop Cooney. He's the only example in this diocese, of course. But it could be. It could not be. I mean, who's to say? Who's to say whether you're going to get, you know, a person who's on a young side or a person who's more advanced in years? So everything is wide open right now as to what that would be. We just have no clue. But whoever it is, I know the people of this diocese will love him, and they will respond to him, and they will form him and shape him just as they form and shape me. And a great appreciation for loving Christ and loving his people. Yeah.
Okay. Your voice is holding out. Do you wish to carry on, or do you want to sign off?
Well, I think I'm going to sign off. Because I can feel the inflammation reoccurring in the throat a little bit.
Okay. So, could you end with...
It's good to shut me off a little bit, so that'd be okay.
Okay, well, if you could end with imparting your blessing.
Sure. The Lord be with you.
And with your spirit.
May the blessing of Almighty God, the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit come down upon you and remain with you always.
Amen.
Amen.
Speak to you later. God bless.
All right. Bishop. Thank you. God bless. Thank you so much.
Okay, Larry. So that was, of course, as we were saying, our bishop, mm-hmm. who we still have for a few more months. But the reason why he asked for the program was not just to discuss what we've just discussed. He also wanted to see if there were some more guidelines that we could give on helping people to cope and try to find the spiritual in this and maybe some fun mm-hmm. as well. So because we've been very somber there, we're losing our bishop. We will get another bishop.
Mm-hmm.
The king is dead. Right. Long live the king, of course. It doesn't mean that we forget about someone, mm-hmm. but we move on. So, coping in this time. So we heard what the bishop's doing. The bishop is praying, fasting, and doing a whole lot of work on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that we haven't talked about in these three sessions is the very real danger. I know. I think we touched upon it in the first one. The very real danger of bad habits
mm-hmm.
being developed. Whether that be the scourge and evil of pornography
mm-hmm.
and or drink
mm-hmm.
or domestic violence, and these are all real things that are happening just now. They happen anyway,
right.
But there's been an increase in them. You're in the front line with a lot of these things. If someone is concerned that one of these things is happening, how are they best going to address that?
Sure. I think this is a really good topic to address because there's a couple dangers or risks that can happen at a time like this. One is simply, you know, the pace of life is slowed and people are home and not maybe going out at all or much at all. And there's a real temptation to just begin to slide, to kind of backslide and to take the path of least resistance. And kind of the typical example of that might be, you know, you wake up later, you sleep in, you don't get dressed, you stay in your pajamas, and you might sit around watching television just because it's easy to do. And we all may take a day to relax from time to time and to just unwind, but the temptation now is that becomes the norm. The problem with that is that those are the behaviors that sometimes are associated with feelings of depression.
Mm.
Because when you stop doing the activities of daily living and you stop being active, a sedentary lifestyle is physically unhealthy, but also very psychologically unhealthy.
And spiritually, of course.
And spiritually, very yes. much, you yes. know, because you're not really engaging, and you're not doing the things that maybe God wants you to do and taking care of your basic needs. The problem in how this exacerbates feelings of depression in particular is that people begin to just pull away from life, to be more isolated, and then begin to feel really bad about that, and down and depressed, and just a sense of hopelessness or helplessness and lack of self-worth. And that contributes to those negative feelings that then people seek relief from. And what we tend to do to seek relief is to do the things that make us feel good in the moment. So we eat the wrong things, we watch the wrong things, and we retreat from life. And so there's a risk at this time because people struggle to get out that those types of patterns and cycles can develop. And you talked about some of the other more active types of addictive behaviors, things like alcohol and drug use, pornography, even arguing and violence in the home can be construed that way. These types of behaviors can develop sometimes when we feel like a situation is out of our control, when we feel like we need to do something to try to gain a measure of control, and also when we feel like we need a sense of relief and escape. And again, those types of cycles can bring negative feelings, feelings of guilt and shame, which then we try to relieve with more relief seeking. And so cycles, especially people who've experienced addiction before, maybe who have a lifelong struggle with addiction or are in recovery from addiction, those things can certainly exacerbate or create a relapse.
Now, one of the things that you mentioned, and we've talked about this in the passing before, self-worth.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So, and I've said this once in a homily, if I was to ask you, who are you?
Mm-hmm.
So many people define themselves by their job.
Right.
By what they see as their worth in society.
Mm-hmm.
My usefulness to society is, I'm a counsellor, I'm mm-hmm. a doctor, I'm a welder, I'm a garbage collector.
Mm-hmm.
And to a certain extent, a lot of that has been taken from people. Right. Or they perceive it to be taken.
Right.
This is a really good opportunity for people to understand their actual worth.
Mm-hmm.
They're made in the image and likeness of God.
Right.
Jesus died for them. And I know people are used to hearing that, but as you've heard me say before, when I say Jesus died for you, I don't mean every single person in the congregation as a gang. Mm-hmm. I mean for you individually. Our Lord's death on the cross is an individual act for each one.
Mm-hmm.
St. Catherine Emmerich, blessed maybe, said that in her visions of our Lord in the Garden of Gethsemane, she saw him see every sin individually committed by every person,
mm-hmm.
and he still took it on,
mm-hmm.
because he loves you as an individual.
Mm-hmm.
What can people do? How can other people help each other
mm-hmm.
to give people an appropriate self-worth, which is not defined by you're a decorator, mm-hmm. you're a mechanic. The natural worth that goes beyond any disabilities,
mm-hmm.
any constraints
right.
Of these things, because we're seeing a crisis in many people's lives of their worth.
Mm-hmm. I think this is a great thing to point out, because it's a frequently experienced crisis in normal days when somebody maybe who has their sense of self-worth tied to a particular job or career, like you pointed out, those can end for any number of reasons. I've worked with a great number of people who their struggle with depression or anxiety or maybe drug and alcohol addiction began with the type of injury that created a disability so that they couldn't do their job.
Yeah.
And I see some similarities here, because all of a sudden many of us are pulled away from the things that we do. It may be a job and a career, or it may be something different, but it pulls us away from those things that define our sense of self-efficacy. And when we link our sense of self-worth to our ability to do things
yes.
and our perceived value in society, then that's subject to change. And we put ourselves kind of at the mercy of those external forces. It really takes, I think, each of us individually a process of change, which in the church we call conversion. It takes that process of change for us to understand that our self-worth does not come from these things. And many times, and this is kind of where I think we have an opportunity here, many times in the normal course of life, it's when we encounter a crisis. When we encounter a crisis where the things that we thought were safe and secure become threatened. And this happens, I would say, to the vast majority of people. It's very unusual for a person to have an intact sense of safety and surety about the world throughout their entire life. It's normal for us to encounter situations where what we believed to be sure about ourselves and about the world is threatened and changed. And so when that happens, we're offered a crisis but also an opportunity to begin to reevaluate what is important to us, including our own sense of self-worth. And this, for some people, is an occasion to have sometimes an emotional crisis, sometimes to slip into depression or anxiety, sometimes to slip into the types of relief-seeking behaviors that we've talked about. But the other opportunity is to turn to the Lord and to discover something new about Him and about ourselves. and I think that discovery is a new type of a relationship. It's that, you know, Bishop talks about this frequently, that encounter that we have with Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. And the beauty of a crisis like this, as tragic as it is that many of us at the same time are forced to ask some of these questions. And that's where, you know, some of these discussions that we've had the past couple of weeks, we've talked about the role of the church. And I think this may be a critical role that our faith plays at this time, which is to show us how we can begin to explore some of the answers to these questions. And as you posed it, if the fundamental threat or the fundamental question is, when my work is taken away and I'm stuck home, or when those activities are taken away, or when my social activities are taken away, those things that I looked to define my day-to-day life and define my sense of self-worth, when all of that changes, what is life about today? Mm. And when we begin to ask that question, I think that is where God stands with the answer.
I remember years ago, I was a can't even remember the name of a play, but I went to see a play in Glasgow, where I'm from, and it was based on the lives of three men who worked on the oil rigs in the North Sea,
mm-hmm.
and they would be away for a month on, 4 weeks on the rigs, 2 weeks off,
mm-hmm.
and one man had the opportunity of taking early retirement,
mm-hmm.
and he took early retirement, and he was back home, and the third week he was back home, his wife said to him, "We can't carry on like this."
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "What do you mean? I don't expect you to be here more than 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. I've got a life to lead." We also have a thing that it's called in Britain, empty nest mm-hmm. syndrome.
Right. Same thing here.
Right. Okay. Where suddenly often couples have to get to know each other better.
Mm-hmm.
You do couple counselling.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
There's a whole lot of self-help couple mm-hmm. counselling that's going to have to go on.
Yeah.
Any tips on people who feel as if they're encroaching each other's personal space, even though they're married to them? Any tips on a way for them to get through this? Maybe to defuse some things? Maybe have some fun in this?
Well, I think... I'll say this because it's a running joke between me and my wife about when I get particularly frustrating, don't engage in pillow therapy. And what I mean by pillow therapy is a pillow over your spouse's face. and you may feel threatened, you know, you may feel like doing that sometimes. And I think it begins with an understanding that we're human beings and we get frustrated and upset at each other frequently. And that's natural. It's natural to do that. It's natural in normal times to just be really frustrated with that other person. And it's easy to do because we're sharing close proximity, so all of our foibles become very visible to the other person. And also because we're connected in such a way, in such a unique way, especially as married couples, that that person has a unique ability to tap into your emotional buttons. And so if we know all that normally...
Can I translate that? Yes. Get under your skin.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And I would add that children as well. Children become yes. very good at this. So that's in normal life. This is, you know, you take all that and then you compound us and you put us together for 2 weeks in the same space. And that becomes compounded by a factor of 10 at least.
Because it's not vacation time.
Exactly.
So it doesn't yeah. have that... That wonder of, let's go see this, let's right. go out on this boat, let's right. do this.
You're almost forced into, for our own safety, we're forced to just spend a whole lot of time, unstructured time together. And for some families, that's experienced as a wonderful thing. For a lot of families, that can be stressful and frustrating. For most of us, it's both. So I think if we begin by acknowledging that and saying that, yep, this is going to be normal, we're going to get under each other's skin, and also that we're going to have some irritation that's a result of transference. And transference simply means that we have a lot of feelings of stress and anxiety about the epidemic, but we don't know how to express it, and so it comes out as irritation toward the other person. If we understand that and we understand each other, we can begin to give a lot of benefit of the doubt and to accept a lot of things in charity. And that can go a long way.
How does the understanding come? I'm thinking people need to stop talking and maybe listen.
Yes, exactly.
And the people who don't talk need to start talking.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because I know that happens in a lot of couples.
Right.
Where the often it's the men
mm-hmm.
just won't say what's on their mind.
Right. Right.
And this is maybe a time where some sharing would be useful.
Right. I think so. And some recognition that maybe if he's really frustrated about trying to fix an appliance in the house that's been broken for 5 years and he's got to do it now, that's maybe a sign of transference about some anxiety about what's happening in the world. And giving each other the benefit of the doubt means we take a step back, we take a breath, we don't take everything quite so seriously. My wife and I, when our kids were younger, were infants especially, we had a rule that anything said to the spouse at 3 a.m. when you're taking care of a crying child is completely forgiven. And that rule worked pretty well because I was usually the one who was waking up after her, and I was usually the one who maybe wasn't quite as helpful, and I would usually hear some comments, and they were well-deserved.
Saying
and
things like, let me hold them.
Right, exactly.
Yes. I know what I'm doing. Let me hold them.
Right, right.
I know you've had them for 2.5 hours.
Right.
But I know the trick.
Right, exactly. Yeah, that didn't go over well.
Yeah.
So if we're able to do that in charity at this time, understanding that the others are frustrated, and especially kids, I do want to say something about children because children are reacting to this in many different ways and especially differently depending on their stage of development. All of our kids they have an intuitive sense of what's happening. And it's really a survival instinct because it's good for them to know when their parents are stressed because it's a sign that maybe things are changing. So as much as we've tried to keep normal life, kids know that there's something different. And I'll give you a beautiful example of this, a very humble example, but my son George is going to be 6 next week. And he came up to us completely seriously today and he said, Dad, I know that because of the governor's order, I might not get any birthday presents. And just a remarkable insight. And I told him that, George, you know, we will get you birthday presents. I promise you will have birthday presents. And he will. But the ability to know that something is different and that my life might be different and to go through the process at, you know, less than 6 to understand that I can cope with that, that life will be okay, and I'll understand and accept that, was something that I think would even be challenging for us as adults. But that's the way he sees this. Older kids, they see a loss of social connection, especially kids, and I'm going to speak to this age because my daughter is around this age, but, you know, 11, 12, 13, and then getting into teenage years, what is primarily valuable to them is their standing among their peers and their connection to their peers, and they're working through those social interactions. And so the ability to be connected to their peers becomes incredibly important. And so being able to foster that, being able to develop that, is critically important. And then kids in more like the middle grade school ages, they are working through issues that have to do with industry, with the ability to learn how to do things. And these ages, I think, are particularly impacted by the suspension of school. Even if they might say that they love being off of school, these ages, you know, I'm thinking of maybe 6 to 10, kids these ages are really focused on learning and practicing new skills. And the loss of that ability to do that in a school setting is difficult and challenging. So a way to address that at home might be to do some new things together, to learn some new things together, and to give them some opportunity to learn and develop mastery over a different set of skills. And then, of course, to keep school going on as much as possible.
I wonder if there would be some advantage, and we're getting close to the end of our time, mm-hmm. of some people perhaps going onto websites for societies that homeschool,
mm-hmm.
because yeah. they'll have suggestions. So a couple of things that we should be saying to people are they need some kind of structure.
Yes.
The families should be taking the time now to pray together. Mm-hmm. That should be part of the structure.
Mm-hmm.
To eat together mm-hmm. as well would be a useful part of the structure, getting everybody involved. And as the bishop had said before, setting tables
mm-hmm.
and maybe even helping to actually make the food.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody feels useful and got yes. a thing. But fun. So yes. in the last 4 minutes, I'm not a fun guy, as you know. So any quick fun things that you've had a go at with the kids
sure.
that you could suggest to, or that you and Megan have had a go at yeah. that the kids didn't like, but you two thought was hilarious. So,
well, we certainly have had a lot of jokes at home. And I think keeping a sense of humor is critically important. It's important to regard this as seriously as it is, but also to have a good sense of humor and to be able to joke around about all kinds of things in that setting. And you have more time to do that, too. One thing that I would suggest that people consider, and I believe is particularly helpful, in Michigan we have an executive order telling us essentially to stay home as much as possible. The executive order by the governor does allow people to go outside for the purpose of exercise, for walking, for biking and hiking. And we've taken advantage of this several times, and I think it was very valuable to do this. If you go out to, we have so many wonderful parks and natural areas around the Alpena area and across the diocese. So, you know, just yesterday we went to one of our parks, and there was another family that went around the same time with just a few other people, and it's a great place to be socially distant but still be socially connected. The nice thing about being outdoors is that you have sunshine and fresh air and air movement, which yeah. is very good to limit exposure to a virus.
That's good for mental health as well, though.
Absolutely. Yeah. There is so much research demonstrating the value of being outdoors in nature as being critical to mental health. And one of the things I was thinking about as I was just, you know, thinking about this time that we're in, is that for the vast majority of human history, our existence was outdoors, and we would come indoors, if there were buildings, we would come indoors for relief from the elements. One of the problems in the unique aspects of our modern society is that we spend most of our time indoors, and we go outdoors for relief from what's happening indoors. So outdoors has become a sense of a getaway or a relief or a place to go for a break, when for the vast majority of human history, it was the opposite. And I think there's something that we've lost, and physically, emotionally, and spiritually, when we lose our connection to the natural world. So this is something that we can rediscover today, because we shouldn't be going to stores. We should limit social connection as much as possible. But it's a wonderful opportunity to renew that connection to nature and to get outside and to do that as a family.
And as we reach the end, thank you very much, Larry, for your ongoing help with these broadcasts.
You're welcome.
I think to sum it all up, there are opportunities for us all within this very troubled time, spiritual, but also physical mm-hmm. as well. So let's end with an Our Father. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Amen. God bless everybody, and thank you for listening.